So whenever somebody came, they could serve up a drink of booze.
Sure, and so we could declare the work day over.
Or else if things got really rough, you could declare a halt to the work day.
Yeah.
So just for the record, excuse me, this is Mike Grayson interviewing Gene Futrell in his office at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. On the 29th of October,
I believe that's correct.
Year 2012, and we're kind of wrapping up a day and a half of fairly intense discussion between the two of us on his career and his contributions to science. So what we want to do here is be a little bit more general in our questioning and just have a half dozen short questions that we'd like to pontificate upon. And the first of the ones that I have listed here is your experience of becoming a scientist. If you're the man from Gryprong.
That's right.
Did you ever envision at any early point in your life that you would end up becoming a scientist? And how do you feel that was where you really ended up is the right place? Or
well. There's no doubt I ended up in the right place, but how I got there is hard to describe.
Well, we've got a day and a half worth of that.
we have a detailed discussion of events, semi-chronologically, of what happened. But no, I had no concept at all as a young person of becoming a scientist. I didn't, you know, my image of a scientist is someone in a white coat. Way in a laboratory somewhere, mm-hmm. Doing something. Mm-hmm. We mentioned earlier in the interview that my first kind of connection, if you please, with science as a kid was when I was in the second grade, and at Christmas time I got a chemistry set. Mm-hmm. So the chemistry set that you could buy in those days is actually a common origin for many chemists. Mm-hmm. So over different times in my career, I've discovered other people, when they were growing up, somehow found a chemistry set, and or they found ways of making flames and explosions and and so on. So chemists seem to have an interest in that. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I started my teaching career, I was about to become a professor at the University of Utah. Mm-hmm. I went back to my alma mater, my PhD institution, University of California at Berkeley, and I went to see the people who were responsible for general chemistry, the upper division chemistry people I had met, because I wasn't required to teach because I had a fellowship mm-hmm. for my entire graduate career. But I wanted to learn what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And so I volunteered, actually, to assist a couple of the senior professors and also to help out in the lab, mm-hmm. not being responsible for the lab, but kind of poking around and talking to the undergraduates who were doing chemistry at the University of California. Mm-hmm. But having missed out on the teaching, mm-hmm. as which is typically part of a university internship sort of a career, I wanted to talk to people, and so I went back and talked to the faculty, to some of the TAs and so on, mm-hmm. and lecture demonstrators, because they had this valuable asset. I recommend that highly, mm-hmm. if you're going to teach general chemistry. Have an expert to do the lecture demonstrations. Do not do it yourself. Mm. And I found that over 90% of the demonstrations were flames or explosions of some kind, highly exothermic reactions. And so that seems to be what catches people's attention, at least in chemistry. Mm-hmm. And in physics, there are different things and so on. But the underlying principal driver I learned many, many years later when I took a psychological test to kind of understand myself mm-hmm. better. And the strongest driving force in my makeup is curiosity.
Yeah.
And so I think curiosity is the driving force of people who get into science, engineering, and so on. If making a lot of money is their motivation, that's probably not the right profession mm-hmm. to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But I also remember, and this it actually became a principle I used later as a teacher, that if you could have a graduate student get to the point where he or she makes a discovery all by themselves, and so they've actually asked a question of Mother Nature,
mm-hmm.
and they get the answer.
Mm-hmm.
They get the answer,
mm-hmm.
okay? So, there's some very, very, very good students that couldn't take the pace in working as a graduate student with me,
mm.
and I think it was because I asked them to do something that was too hard or whatever first,
mm-hmm.
and they never got to the point where you, yourself, are the only person in the world who knows the answer to a serious question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you gotta tell somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's another key part of mm-hmm. being a scientist, is you have to tell somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a rather stale, formalized
right.
way of doing that, and that's too bad in some sense. But there's a very formalized structure of communicating scientific discovery.
Mm-hmm.
It involves other people, your peers, or sometimes senior people in the field you're just getting into. They look very carefully at what you've done, and occasionally they punch holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
As I've advanced in my career, I found out that was fun too, to punch holes in some accepted theory, mm-hmm. idea, understanding of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Still doing that. Okay, so at a career that started for me, let me say formally, I guess in terms of posing questions and trying to get answers at about age 21, so that's more than 50 years ago, it's
mm-hmm.
approaching 60,
mm-hmm.
so to have this privilege
mm-hmm.
of being able to design, craft a serious question and figure out how to address that question. And sometimes it involves other people. Frequently it does.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bigger the question, the more people have to be involved to provide the answer, and the more information you have to think about
mm-hmm.
to pose a question. But there's still that moment of discovery when you're excited because you know something
yeah.
and no one else knows.
No one else knows.
As a teacher, what has thrilled me the most, actually, is when I know perfectly well what answer should happen, and have a good student who's helping to answer that question, doing things with his or her hands,
mm-hmm.
and posing that question. And they get an answer that's not the one I expected. Why not? Okay? And so then that's even more exciting when, based on all your knowledge accumulated for more than 50 years, and you're wrong. Because then it's something that's really significant that's come to your attention. So what should I say? It's the thrill of the hunt.
Okay.
In a very different sense.
The intellectual hunt.
Intellectual hunt, yes.
In this last century, I would say, I think the presence of women in science has increased dramatically. And I just have visited your lab and been introduced to two very brilliant and exciting women scientists who are quite knowledgeable. What is your attitude towards women in science these days, and through your career, and how it's changed?
My reaction to women has been the same since I was a teenager. Wow! Now the reasons for saying wow have changed somewhat as you get older, and I'm thrilled
mm-hmm.
that there are so many women in science nowadays. I still remember the first PhD student, first woman that got a PhD with me.
Mm.
It was distressingly far along in my career.
Mm.
Because when I started in my career, it was really rare to encounter women at, let's say, Research One universities
mm-hmm.
doing cutting-edge research. So Julie Biggerstaff was my first woman PhD. This was actually at the University of Delaware, which was my sort of fourth station stop in doing my own research. And so it took a long time for women to emerge. Earlier on in my interview, we talked about the fact that the French spelling of my name, which is ancestral in its origin, and we can go back to France, and that's a very common name, and French Canada, a very common name. It's not so uncommon in Louisiana, but nevertheless, I was assigned to the women's dorm when I started college. I lasted for about 5 minutes before I was ejected. but anyhow, I've been often mistaken for a woman, and I still get pantyhose occasionally that my wife is delighted to have. And so these sort of come-on advertising things that come in the mail may be misdirected. And we got a lot of phone calls, particularly asking for political donations lately, where my wife answers the phone and they think that she is Jean and so on and launch into that. So anyhow, I certainly experienced in subtle ways, I would say, no obvious ways, no confrontational ways, but I experienced in subtle ways in my career as I was starting out before I became a known quantity in the scientific community, I experienced subtle discriminations. Again, we described in my interview when I got a letter from a vendor that I thought had done a terrible thing in the chemical that they had supplied for my laboratory that had nasty consequences well beyond what they might have anticipated. And the letter started out, "My dear Miss Futrell, what you have described as could not happen." So that was the most overt example that I personally experienced. And I responded in a very specific way. I called them on the phone and in my gruffest voice explained that I was Dr. Futrell, please. And that there was no doubt what I had said in my letter was absolutely correct. And it was, of course, absolutely correct. I wouldn't have made those accusations without knowing they were true. I had another experience as a woman, actually, when I started my academic career at the University of Utah. Again, because of my name, I was misinterpreted by a prestigious book titled is more or less Who's Who Among American Women, or American Women in Science, or some such title. And so this was a very scholarly book that had full interviews with people who were doing outstanding things scientifically. And I looked at the book and liked a good bit of it. But they had an appendix where they put in names of people that were noteworthy for recognition, names of women that they did not have time to interview. And I had been identified, as it turned out, as the youngest woman full professor in a Research One University science department in the United States.
Oh, wow.
So for 2 or 3 years, I was getting phone calls from sociology departments or psychology departments. I could have been the subject of several theses, but for the technicality that I was not an outstanding young woman full professor. And so it was clearly there. Okay. And it's still there, but it's disappearing. To leap forward to my academic responsibilities when I was at the University of Delaware as a department chair. We had the distinction for a few years of having more women on our faculty than any other Research One University Department of Chemistry. And I was fortunate to have several full professors as women. And I was trying to hire more smart women, but mainly as assistant professors, so young scientists who were getting into the teaching profession. And I found out it was easy to convince my male colleagues that so-and-so was very good and was worthy of serious consideration for appointing as a woman assistant professor. The Fuller professors, who'd had such a difficult time battling their way to the top, they were much stricter in their criteria for hiring a woman than I was.
This is your women professors.
My women professors. My women professors were the ones that it was difficult to convince that some young potential colleague was deserving of a chance to work with them on the faculty.
So in your position, a training research scientist, you had the opportunity to mentor a variety of people, and you've also been mentored in your career. What kinds of comments can you make about the mentoring that you got in progressing in the scientific career?
Well, that's a fascinating question to think about. Mentoring, and I might just mention, we again discussed in my interview that my present title at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory is a Battelle Fellow. Battelle Fellow is a corporate designation, and one of the characteristics is you can describe what you want to do, and then P&L will look at it, and if they agree, then you have a plan for what you'll be doing for the next year or sometimes 2 years. And so oddly enough, one of my assignments, I'm actually paid part of my salary for doing it, is to mentor younger scientists. The two young women that you met today, that you commented that they were really impressive scientists, knew what they were doing, interesting science, and so on, are two of the people that I mentor. And it's fun to talk to them, as you can imagine. And I think it's amazing that I'm paid part of my salary for doing something like that. Now, mentoring, what mentoring did I get? I got guidance. I don't think I got mentoring very much. And actually, philosophy, when I was in school, in the early years of my career, was more to bust people out, you know, to knock them out of the system, rather than inviting them in and talking about some of the great possibilities. It was a different era, because it was the Cold War, and we were very concerned about what was happening in the Soviet Union. Sputnik flew into the air, was orbiting the Earth while I was a graduate student, and so getting the best people in science was a very strong national priority. And because of this, a lot of people were trying that were not judged to be by the faculty in charge to be capable of doing that. And so the whole attitude is there's lots of raw material to go into science. And so you can be pretty harsh in how people are treated. The way that I sort of felt I was mentored, to use your word, as a graduate student, was so different from what they wrote in the letters of recommendation after I had succeeded in going through the experience of it was my privilege to be at what was the number one university in the United States for what I was interested in doing at that point in time. And so it was remarkable to have that opportunity. But it was not the happiest time of my life. By any means. I think had I not had a couple of those moments where all of a sudden I had an answer. And in particular, when I proved the more senior people wrong and could talk about it in a research seminar, that was fun. That was fun. Still is. Still is, after all these years. Mentoring. Very, very important. So when I had a position of administrative responsibility as a department Ed. Mentoring was a big part of what I was doing with younger faculty, and so they had a big brother that had someone had agreed to work with them and help them to get started, and I actually did quite a bit of that myself, and so I saw to it that I funded out of departmental discretionary funds, I funded travel for my junior faculty, assistant professors without tenure, helped to guide them on how to get an invitation to give a seminar at a major university that had one or more faculty members, senior faculty members working in their field, so get them the experience of going out and talking about their science and so on. And I personally took them to Washington, D.C. to meet program officers in primarily National Science Foundation for university scientists, but also other funding agencies. So they became known persons, and they knew the people at the other end. And generally, program officers are surprised when someone comes in, takes the time to visit with them, and so on. So mentoring is a really important part of the training of a young scientist. And I think what I did is no longer exceptional. I think it's the way it's done nowadays.
Science is actually, probably surprisingly to a lot of people, a fairly competitive business. And I was just wondering what you think about the kinds of competition that you've experienced in your scientific career.
Well, now. it was a surprise to me. Let me back up a second and say that my approach to science, I finally figured out what I did after I'd been doing it for a goodly number of years. But it was to think of a problem for quite some time. And how is it that you can approach solving this problem? And in my case, it very frequently involved some kind of innovation, to take an existing spectroscopic tool or something like that, operate it in a different way, to run an experiment backwards, think about it backwards, and if you run it backwards, what are the implications for running it forwards, and then maybe developing a special approach that would give you a definitive answer when your competition, people who are writing the literature, sometimes much better known than you are interpreting things in a certain way. And when I could give a definitive answer, I thought they'd want to know that. Well, guess what? I think you probably know this, but scientists are just people. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they have our strengths and our weaknesses. And I'm sorry to say, sometimes the drive to succeed causes people to be selective in their data.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever done that. I've been my most severe critic, I think, in terms of doing experiments. I like to think that. But you know, there are historical things that I looked into. Millikan oil drop experiment was one that I was interested in, just reading about it and looking into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got access to copies of his original notebooks. And he put circles around the right answer, okay? And he ignored a lot of numbers that was given the wrong answer. Now, he didn't explain why he did that. I'm quite sure that he had a reason, okay? But he didn't put it in the notebooks.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just looked at it objectively, you would say that he's selecting numbers as if he knew the right answer. But nobody knew the right answer.
Yeah.
Okay? And so you couldn't accuse him of cheating because he was the first one
right.
to get the right answer and get it to three significant figures. So anyhow, the graduate student who worked with him in doing the critical experiments actually had gotten his undergraduate degree at the University of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we invited him back, and I was his host. And he didn't know why his boss circled these answers. They apparently didn't discuss it as much as I tried to do with my students when we were doing things together. And so anyhow, there are certain biases that creep in. There are some that are not bad biases, okay? A saying of Henry Eyring, one of my dear colleagues at the University of Utah, a very famous scientist, is that he described his theory that he was famous for as not being completely correct. Had flaws in it. He knew that. He talked to me about some of the flaws, and he tried to discover them first. Occasionally, somebody else discovered one or another of the errors. But he says it's awfully close to right.
Mm.
And having done it enough times, having been a practicing physical chemist for a number of years, I can guess the answer with pretty good intuitive accuracy. And if the answer you guess is not the one that's verified by your calculations, or in my case, by your experiment, think it over again.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably something wrong with your experiment. If there isn't, if there is not, then you've really discovered something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, how is it received? Sometimes joyfully, sometimes with enthusiasm, sometimes with a little jealousy because they didn't have the proper tool to do the experiment and get the answer, and so on. So scientists are people.
Mm-hmm.
You encounter all spectrums of emotion and talent and whatever. And there are even some people that I knew that were graduate students for a while, had incredible intuition.
Mm.
If I could somehow have gotten them to do the math and to survive an oral exam at the end,
mm-hmm.
I think they would have been great scientists and recognized.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do it just because you're good at something, because you have a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And science is creative, okay? I don't think the public image of a scientist is of a creative person.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really true.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, way back in ancient history, it means before I was born, back in Vienna, there were actually orchestras and consisted of scientists, orchestras that were all mathematicians, and so on. And so interest in art, music, those kinds of things is not completely foreign to a scientist. And as we mentioned already, my wife is a noted artist who has work in the Smithsonian collection. And clearly she's a creative person. No one would doubt that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that visits my office, actually, to see that some of her work that's hanging on the walls or our home would agree that she's creative. They wouldn't immediately guess that I'm creative.
Mm-hmm.
But I claim that I am, and my artist wife agrees. I guess that means some of the things that I talk to her about are so crazy from her perspective. That she agrees that they are creative.
Fantasies.
Fantasies, yes. Somewhere between creative and fantasies.
So you've spent a number of years, some number of decades in the scientific field. How do you think it has changed from your beginning of your career until the present time, the whole business of practicing science and pursuing science? How has it different now than it was in the beginning?
Well, I guess the speed of doing things more than anything else. Of course, in our interview, we talked about my career in mass spectrometry, how I got into it, and I described how painful it was to obtain a mass spectrum, essentially so precious a device no graduate student could come near it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I think the only chemistry departments that actually had commercial mass spectrometers might have been the University of California at Berkeley. And that was not in the department, actually. It was in the National Laboratory. And students could have access to that. The departments of chemistry that did mass spectrometry typically were places where the pioneers were,
mm-hmm.
that built their own. And so at the time I was entering the field, there were very few and very simple mass spectrometers. We discussed the fact that mass spectrometry really got launched in significant numbers by the oil companies,
mm-hmm.
during World War II. They were invented to control what they needed to do in refineries. And so that's where they were. And therefore, early leaders in the field, practitioners, probably many more, came from oil companies than from universities, for example. So it was very delicate and time-consuming business.
Mm-hmm.
We saw today one of my colleagues who worked with me for a dozen years, maybe a little bit more, in the laboratory, and I'm quite sure that he obtains more mass spectra in an afternoon than my students and I did my entire career. No doubt.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt that he does that.
Mm-hmm.
And so extremely high throughput is a characteristic now of doing certain types,
mm-hmm.
of mass spectrometry. So instead of a week to get an answer, the instrument gets it in a fraction of a second, and the computer tells you what you've done. And so huge change,
mm-hmm.
in the speed at which data is obtained. And actually, I'm thinking of a conversation I had with distinguished chemist Linus Pauling,
mm-hmm.
Two Nobel Prizes to his credit, and he's somewhat older,
mm-hmm.
and not able to have this interview with you, but I remember a conversation where he objected to all of this detail. Conversation is, I was showing him a gas chromatogram that one of my students had obtained, and with a mass spectrometer we could put names on all the peaks. And this was a capillary column gas chromatograph.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were literally hundreds of peaks. And Linus Pauling looked at it and he said, "I don't like this at all. I can't see a pattern. Mm-hmm. I can't get the science that's behind this piece of paper that you're showing to me."
Mm-hmm.
So a really visionary scientist was not prepared to deal with data.
Mm-hmm.
Frustration of mine is that you have this wealth of data, and most of the practice of science has several computers in between you and the actual,
mm-hmm.
experiment.
Mm-hmm.
That's a personal frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a characteristic of the 21st century, absolutely missing in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, I think it's harder to have these kind of breakthrough thoughts where you see what nature is trying to tell you that you haven't thought of yet. I say that despite the fact that I've published theoretical papers on pattern recognition and use computers, and I too have sinned, but I'm not comfortable with it. I have to say that. I'm not comfortable with it.
So lastly, I'd like to get your opinion about a general theme of science in the public, the impact of, say, science on the common man, or perhaps the impact of your scientific work on the common man. But I think this is becoming more and more crucial with, unfortunately, what I see is the politicization of science today. So, talk to me about the science, how you think science is seen by the public, and how the common man sees it, and how maybe the work that you've done has impacted the common man.
Well, my impact on the common man has been fairly indirect, in the sense of a number of breakthroughs that lead to new instrumentation, and the new instrumentation eventually becomes commercialized, or not. But a number of things that were discoveries at different points in my career appear in commercial instruments, several of which you saw today in your tour of this laboratory, doing fantastic experiments at a fantastic rate. And then eventually the results of this information are communicated. But I think our communication to the general public is seriously flawed. It's lacking in both, what should I say? The essential message gets lost in terms of how it's finally interpreted to the public. In many cases, we have in this laboratory a whole department responsible for communication. Before you escape, I'll give you a number of brochures, and I'll even point to some and say, well, that's not really true. It sounds good, but it isn't. And so the communication step has, in this age of specialization, kind of stands by, between the practitioners of science, the real scientists, and the public to whom it's communicated. We do better as a scientific community with the federal agencies that are charged with responsibilities of funding science. Why? Because it requires money. And again, the big change from when mass spectrometry was a cottage industry that people built their own to, you know, thousands of them are sold throughout the world every year. Total change in the way things are done. And the specialization. So people in this laboratory are represented to the outside world by a number of different people. To the funding agencies, they're represented by administrators who are charged with communicating the value of what we're doing and so on. Then people in communications who produce glossy brochures and videos and things like that, and digital communications, social media. We have a public website that we invite people to look at, and then we have the internal website because there's security issues that separate us from the public outside. Sometimes penetrated. I just noticed that I was a wealthy person because I got an email telling me I got an unimaginable sum of money. Well, this is not true. And probably more than 50% of the information comes through me, having been filtered by 100 or so people that are supposed to catch messages that are inappropriate, because they mention something that sounds like it might be real, comes in. So I spend a discouraging part of my time rejecting communications that are aimed at me. Well, our communications are inspired by trying to communicate the value of science, communicate it to the scientific public, communicate it to our sponsors, federal government, and because the source of all this is taxpayers, to the public at large. And so we have a very large investment in communication. But I don't think it works very well. And so there are some things that get lost in the interpretation as goes from one to another to another. And the general public is bombarded with so much information, as you and I know, having grown up before cell phones existed, mm-hmm. and before people had laptop computers, and before I had my iPhone and my iPad and mm-hmm. all of the essential things you carry on the airplane these days, bombarded by just tremendous amount of information. And a significant fraction is pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. It's not real. Mm-hmm. And so there are a number of sources of information that pretend to be scientific that really are not. Mm-hmm. The people who are introduced as scientists are not. Universities, how many universities do we have nowadays that have no campus, no contact between a professor and a student, but people are paying money to get a degree that says you have a university degree. Mm-hmm. That's not the university education that you and I have. And it doesn't mean the same thing at all. Science is a contact sport. We talked about that. You have to communicate with people, and it's very much a human endeavor. I like to think it's part of what distinguished humans from our ancestors, and when it became more important to be in an air-conditioned office, an air-conditioned laboratory, thinking profound thoughts, than to take your club out and kill a tiger. Mm-hmm. So we've advanced as a civilization. I think science and technology is equally important. So that's the application of scientific knowledge to enable us to do things better, faster, cheaper. We've experienced this speed up over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. There are things that people think of, public understanding, as things that are called laws and theories, are not laws and not theories. First of all, a scientific law has nothing to do with the practice of law, mm-hmm. and you find that out as soon as you get in a lawsuit, for whatever reason, innocent though you are. So you understand law as a different way of practice than science does. I don't think it's as creative. That's my personal opinion. But anyhow, one of the laws that has governed our lives for a few decades now is Moore's Law. Mm-hmm. So Moore's Law says the speed of computing, has a doubling time. And this was obeyed for more than two decades, I think, perhaps more than three decades. But it's not true anymore, okay? Because it never was a law. Mm-hmm. It was not prescribed by physics and physics principles. It was an observation that humans, scientists, engineers, technologists, were clever enough to figure out ways of doing things faster and faster and faster and faster. And the devices to do it got smaller and smaller and smaller. But we've hit the physical limit, okay? You can no longer maintain an information bit and make it faster and faster and faster. So that's why the room that we have computers in has expanded another 50%. Mm-hmm. Because we got to put more of them to double our speed or triple our speed of communication, of use of computers. And of course, probably a third of our computer space is now information. Mm-hmm. What do you do with information? So there's a whole new specialty in finding out what the patterns are that nature knows about and we do not. The image of a scientist, my image of a scientist, has changed dramatically over time. And I think to the general public it's even more foggy notion.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. I think that kind of wraps it up, unless you have any final comments you want to, parting wisdom that you want to give to the ages.
Well, I don't think I have any real wisdom to impart to the ages. You know, there are a few principles we've talked about, particularly in my interview. I think not being afraid to admit you don't know the answer is an important philosophy that people should keep in mind and in all walks of life. One of the things that has occurred in the information age is now you can find either an answer out there. Frequently you find several answers, not all of which can be correct. But by doing a little research, starting with the internet, and maybe going to an old-fashioned thing like a library, you can identify a person who knows a lot more about a question than you do. And it doesn't hurt to ask. And you can generally get them pretty quickly nowadays. So it's a golden age of science. An ancient quotation is, this is the best of times, this is the worst of times. Best of times of being able to do things. Worst of times in terms of sorting out what it is that you can do and should do in contrast to the things that might be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the best I can do for a closing remark.
I think that's probably pretty darn good.
Thank you, Mike. This has been fun.
Yes, well, I've enjoyed it. And, let's see, I gotta put that guy away and turn this guy off here.
Stop.